You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
We light our chalice today as a symbol of our shared faith. May our belief shine in our hearts as guiding stars. Good morning and welcome to our service of worship. The land we meet on today is the traditional land of the Kaurna people, and we respect and bless their spiritual relationship with their country and their elders past and present. Our Unitarian Church is a spiritual community, one that supports you in seeking and following your own spiritual path. Today's service is devoted to Mozart, the real Mozart, the one who wrote much deeply religious music, loved life and women and fun, and had a profound understanding of death. There will be more music than usual and time for reflection. Mozart was a Christian. He was a Freemason and a bit of a rebel with regard to the Church of Rome. He may have some kindred spirits here. Please do join us after the service for conversation and coffee, thanks to Sandy Schultheis, whom I helped hardly at all this morning. And our first segment is music for all ages. Because we haven't got the children here, there's no reason to dump it, because I had cleverly inserted facts that I wanted to remind the adults of anyway. So indulge me. What I was going to say was Mozart was the youngest of seven children, which was an average-sized family at the time. Unlike Bach's, who was big. Bach had 20 and half of them died. Well, the Mozart family was rather worse off than that. Of the seven, only two survived. Mozart, Wolfgang Amadeus, and Nannerl, that's Maria Anna. They were carted all over Europe, making money, as they were both prodigies. And Wolfgang's first composition was the minuet and trio in G major, and it was much better than any five-year-old has a right to write. It's listed as K1, catalogue number. By the time he was 35, he made it up to K671. So that piece that Margaret played at the beginning, about halfway through. And as she did the cross hands, I thought, I can just imagine the laced silk hand going across and doing the show-off bit in a concert. We don't hear much about his sister because at age 18 her career stopped. In those times it was against the rule for young women to tour and perform. They had to marry and have children. Mozart could compose for every occasion, and if you ever want to know the difference between Haydn and Mozart, you think, was that Haydn or what was that Mozart? If in half an hour's time you can sing the tune, it was Mozart. But what I was going to show the kids today, was how he could mess around with a tune everyone knew. And you'd listen to it and think, how's he going to get back to that? And of course he always would. So we'll have a look at the variations on Avu Deresje Maman. 12 Variationen, apparently. Remember that last year it was the 250th anniversary of Beethoven's birth, and we commemorated it here at church with a service Margaret played, and I talked about his beliefs, his values, his music, and his heroic struggle with deafness. By contrast, Mozart seems to be a featherweight, musically and as a person. His father Leopold had conniptions when he fell out with his employer, the Archbishop of Salzburg. Leopold wasn't too keen on Mozart's choice of a wife, Constanze, who a bit of an airhead. Mozart was hopeless with money. He offended another composer, Salieri, who poisoned him, and he was slung into a pauper's grave. Now, if that were all true, I wouldn't be dedicating the service to Mozart today because it just wears us down. It's too negative, too depressing. But I did a little research and discovered Mozart was a man of spiritual depth, a man of determination to make the best of his gifts despite a fragile constitution. He was a man with a positive view of death, one who married a very fine musician and astute businesswoman, a man who lost his best friend when he lost his father, one who left a family provided for, and the world a rich legacy of incredibly beautiful music. Imagine that in a cathedral. His life raises some interesting questions, starting with his death. He was 35. Was that the huge tragedy it seems to be? The loose ends. Süssmayr Constanza. Lots of people had a lot to pick up. And that, of course, raises the question in our own lives. How do we seek to reduce the loose ends that we leave? How do we make sure we're not a burden? These are all thoughts. As Helen read, very few composers die just as they've finished a composition. And it's the same in our lives. We won't die when we get to the end of one project. Very unlikely. And other things that we may worry about are our reputation. What about the memories people will have of us? Does it matter if people believe lies about us? What if people get us terribly wrong? Why do people get Mozart so wrong? Let's start with that one. The revenge, jealousy, murder theme comes to my generation from the movie Amadeus and the stage play of the same name by Peter Schaffer. I saw it in London in 1982. It was colossally entertaining with a great soundtrack, that's the movie, but it was historically dodgy. In it, you see Salieri taking dictation from Mozart on his deathbed. Confutatis, confutatis. A minor? Yes, yes, voce me, sotto voce. Write that down. Yes. Underneath, just violins, arpeggios, descending, eighth notes, back to the ostinato again. No, 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 no. Trumpets in D. No, no. Listen to me. I don't understand. I don't understand. It's not realistic. Of course Salieri would understand terms like arpeggio, sotto voce, ostinato. What the director was trying to do was to show how Mozart could imagine the whole score in his head and just get it set down without erasure or correction. But we know it was Süssmayr who took the dictation and instruction from Mozart, not Salieri. In the movie, the Requiem was commissioned by a mystery servant in a spooky black mask. Mozart, destitute and ill, accepts a commission to write a Requiem Mass. The person extending the request was anonymous and sent a messenger in his stead, dressed in a dark cloak, and he would bring money and follow the progress of the Requiem. Now, in real life, Mozart did receive a commission. It was delivered to him by a tall messenger. It may have been clothed in grey or black, but he would have known the master. The master was Count Wolczek, and he was a very, very wealthy man who made a habit of inviting good musicians to play or write string quartets with him, which he would then pass off as his own. He had a young wife whom he lost, sadly, which would have aroused Mozart's sympathies. Besides, Mozart had had a bad run financially for a couple of years. He was in debt to the tune of 45,000 euros in today's money. His creditor, a prince, was starting to sound litigious. So why wouldn't he say yes to, I want you to write a Requiem Mass and here's a great deal of money? Besides, he'd done it before. Back when he worked for the famously economical Archbishop of Salzburg, he would write stuff for Michael Haydn, that's the brother of Joseph. Michael had a bit of a drinking problem which made it very difficult to meet deadlines. So what I'm saying is Mozart was likely to be both sympathetic and amused by the subterfuge. His other two fat commissions were for two huge works, the operas The Magic Flute and The Clemency of Titus, the former in Vienna, the latter in Prague, premiering only 3 weeks apart, and Mozart conducted them both. Now, there were no buses, no airlines, no fast trains. Mozart had reason to feel pressured. On top of that, there was a clarinet concerto in the pipeline too. That's a very heavy workload for a sick man, and one commission was relegated to the back burner. It was the Requiem, and that got to him. He got a bit obsessed by it, to the extent that Constanza would take the score away from him, hide it, and make him go for a walk with her in the park in the famous Prater. Well, by September, both operas were launched. Someone else had to write the recitatives for La Clemenza di Tito. Conductor Jane Glover says, and boy, can't you tell. This Italian opera wasn't a raging success, but Die Zauberflöte in German certainly was. Now, in the movie, Salieri is very snide about this. We sat, as he wished us to, among ordinary Germans. The smell of sausage and sweat was almost annihilating. "This is so exciting," he says to Mozart. "Do you think so?" "Oh, yes, this is exactly the audience we should be writing for, not the dreary court. As always, you show the way." And then he talks directly out of the screen to the audience. As always he did, my pungent neighbours rolled in their benches at the jokes, and I alone, in their midst, heard the magic flute. He goes on to gloat that he encouraged Mozart to include all the Freemasonry elements in the magic flute, thereby offending the men of influence in Vienna. "He did not get half his receipts from the opera," he gloated. Except it's nonsense. Mozart was a Mason from the age of 28 till his death. His father Leopold became one too on a visit to Vienna. This is proof of the mutual love and respect between father and son. Masonry supported morality, charity, mutual support, the belief in a supreme being, the immortality of the soul, and obedience to the law of the land without subservience and making confessions to the priests of the Roman Catholic Church. The myths about Mozart were perpetuated and amplified by Schaffer, have to do with the need to write a really good script full of dramatic conflict. Amadeus was less about the genius of Mozart and more about the envy of his rival Salieri, whose curse it was to have the talent of a third-rate composer, but the ear of a first-rate music lover, so he knew how bad he was and how good Mozart was. The playwright never let the facts get in the way of a good story. In the movie, Miloš Forman balanced the leading characters so well that he got a double Best Actor for it, plus 6 or 7 other Academy Awards. Well, let's get back to the genius of Mozart. If you look at the top 10 most frequently played classical music works on YouTube, Mozart comes in twice at number 4 and number 8. And not for Eine kleine Nachtmusik or The Magic Flute or The Marriage of Figaro or The Horn Concerto. Nearly 1 billion viewings were for Mozart's Requiem in fourth place, and 72 million viewings for the Lacrimosa in eighth place. That was the part of the Requiem that I just played the clip of. Day of tears, when from the ashes will arise the man found guilty. Spare him by your mercy, Lord, gentle Lord Jesus. Grant him eternal rest. It's sung in Latin, and frankly, it's not the words, but the beauty of the music that draws people in, the serenity, the rest. Mozart wrote in full 8 bars of it, and the remainder of it is in Süssmayr's handwriting. He completed it according to Mozart's sketches and recommendations. Once Mozart got sick, and after he died, Constanze took over financial management, and she was good at it. She extracted the commission from Count Walsegg for the Requiem and got Mozart credited with it as the composer. She did great deals with publishers and died quite well off. What's incredible about the Requiem is how positive it is. It's not morbid and full of lamentation. It is incredibly beautiful. It could be done with a whacking great orchestra like Osespi in Sao Paulo, or a small one. It can be done with modern instruments or period. It can be done in a concert hall, a cathedral, or a theatre. The mood of the opening is immensely solemn, but no gloomier than that. The Dies Irae is dramatic, of the theatre rather than the cathedral, I think. Day of wrath, this day of anger will dissolve the world in ashes.
Thank you.
That poem is in addition to the Mass. It's what makes the Mass a Requiem Mass. The rhythm is compelling. Dies irae, dies illa. The Lacrimosa, it must be admitted, is spooky because it was the very last thing that Mozart wrote in full. The very last line he wrote in full was Judicandus iomul reus, the guilty man goes to be judged. He brings in the trumpet and the timpani for those words. When he was a child, he had a phobia about the trumpet. A friend of his father's played trumpet, and all this man had to do was to bring the case, put it on the table, and start opening it, and Mozart would run screaming from the room. It was a small apartment, maybe it was the noise. Mozart's own attitude to death, until he faced it himself, was very positive. He was a devout Christian, and he believed that when we pass on, we go to somewhere better. There's a wonderful letter that he wrote to his father in 1787 about death being the true goal of our existence, and I'm going to read it to you. His father at this stage was sick. I am counting on good news, although I make a practice of always imagining the worst. As death is the true purpose of life, I have for many years made myself familiar with that best friend of man, and his face has now no longer any terror for me, but is, if anything, calm and consoling to look upon. I thank God for this blessing, and I never go to bed without thinking perhaps on the morrow I may no longer be alive. And yet no one who knows me could say I'm sad or discontented. I give thanks to my Creator for this happiness and hope with all my heart. My fellow creatures may share it. And he was indeed a very cheerful person. Now, I said before that he was a true Christian, but you know, the Buddhists also believe in that practice of dwelling on impermanence, dwelling on the proximity and the inevitability of death. It sharpens your appreciation of life. Death is the key that unlocks the door to our true happiness. And maybe that is why the Requiem resonates so much with people. It's a celebration of life, not just mourning for a lost soul. By the time we get to the Lacrimosa, of course we have to mourn and sob, but we don't stay there. When we get to Lux Aeterna, it's strong and positive. The trumpets here are not terrifying like they were in the Lacrimosa. Here they're inspiring. The music goes into a major key. It's exhilarating. Let eternal light shine on them. Lord, grant them eternal rest because you are merciful. Thank you. It's extraordinary that such a solemn work from the 18th century is played so much today and in so many ways. The concert ticket that I spent more money on than for any other in my life was for the 2020 Adelaide Festival of Arts production, which was developed in Provence, southern France, by Romeo Castellucci. His vision for it was threefold: a mass for the dead, a reflection on the finite, and a celebration of life. It began with the wonderful colours and beauty of the Renaissance, but was infiltrated by the fear of extinction, wiping us out as individuals and as a species. The connection with climate change was inescapable. The deaths symbolically occurred on the wreck of a modern automobile. Parts of the world disintegrated. The whole set was rolled up and carted out, and at the end, a baby appeared center stage in front of a brightly colored wooden toy. The lights came up and no one applauded. Everyone was afraid of scaring the unattended baby. The mother scooted across the stage, scooped the child up, and the applause was tumultuous. It was very moving. What a legacy. And that brings me back to that question about the tragedy of Mozart's early death. Was it a tragedy, or was it a fulfilled life? What counts, quantity or quality? We know that Constanze and the two surviving kids were okay. What about the unmarked grave? Well, the pauper's grave, so-called. Well, that was how things were done in Vienna at that time. Big funerals and memorials were discouraged. In fact, they were against the law. Few people attended burials. Bodies were buried in shrouds, not lavish coffins. Mozart achieved a tremendous amount in his lifetime. Constanze organized concerts in his memory and had his works published. She married a Danish diplomat, and her two sons were well educated in Prague. Her husband died, and she finished the biography that she and her husband had worked on together. She went back to Salzburg, where she was reunited with her sisters. Her younger son, Franz, was a great comfort to Nano, his aunt, Mozart's sister, in her old age. Nano's story is one for another day. And so is the true story of Constanze, who was not unmusical, nor unintelligent, nor unfaithful, nor neglectful, nor unworthy. Grove's Musical Dictionary attributes this bad press to 20th century anti-feminism and a lack of regard for evidence. And that brings us to how we feel about our own mortality. I'm going to wager that most of us would identify with Dido's Lament. The composer is Purcell, who predates Mozart by about a century. The singer is Annie Lennox. I offer no commentary. I've had enough to say. May the song sing for itself.
May my
my feet.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitariansa@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians.